Why is it, do you think, children are always too young to hear the truth, but never too young to be lied to systematically, conscientiously, in the name of education?
This is Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. Listen online at freakradio.org. And welcome to Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. Today we have a guest in the studio. John Brown Childs is a retiring professor at UC Santa Cruz, an author, a Fulbright scholar, and sociologist. Welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask, to do a better bio. Transcommunality, Hurricane Katrina, Response and Responsibilities, contributor to Readings for Diversity and Social Justice, in honor of my ancestors, Massachusetts, Bretherton, Oneida, Madagascan specifically, accommodationism, messianism, years and years of scholarly articles and research and work, but also community-based social justice work in organizations and at a street level as opposed to at a university classroom level.
Right.
If you could talk just briefly about your area of research, writing, expertise specifically.
Sure. First of all, I'd say that as you were listing these various writings, I would say that my writings always has been influenced and is influenced by the community work that I do. And vice versa. I mean, it's a circle. What goes around comes around. And I always learn from the work that I'm involved with, in the community. Not because I'm doing research on the community, but because the experiences themselves teach me. So I work with Barrios Unidos, United Neighborhoods in Santa Cruz, and I've learned a lot from working with them. So, it's like I'm a teacher, but I'm also a student. And constantly. And so there's always a connection between these two domains, for me anyway.
So with 20 years of teaching on campus at UCSC and more years of teaching before that, I guess to reflect on those years as someone who's stepping back from that role, can you talk a little bit about what you've seen change within the student body or the university mm-hmm. population or the students that come into your classroom?
Right. Well, on one side, I'd say let's call it the positive side, just to be kind of schematic about it. I think that just in general, when I think back on the civil rights movement in the 1960s that I had a little bit of involvement with, that this we have a much richer, more diverse understanding of the complexity of society than many of us did in the 1960s. So being much more cognizant of cultural heterogeneity, everything, gender, culture, physical capabilities, etc., it has been a tremendous, wonderful kind of expansion of the sense of who is in society. And to some degree, I think you can see that change, the positive change at the university. There are more student organizations that are reach out to a wide range of diverse perspectives than there were when I arrived there in 1987. So I think, in a sense, it's a richer political, cultural environment at the ground level. That's the positive side.
Okay.
The negative side in terms of the university, it seems to me, is that more and more the state universities in many places are being forced toward a more corporate, privatized model in which emulate business is the bumper sticker. And the tendency is to think in terms of where the money comes from. And so and the more cash-strapped universities get, the more interested they become in big money. And big money, of course, can only come from two places, big government and big business. Okay, fine. That leaves out, usually, unless you have a social national agenda that includes culture and cultural diversity, it leaves out the arts, like poetry, for example, painting, It leaves out the humanities. It leaves out the social sciences to a large degree. And what I'm afraid of for the University of California in general, and UCSC in particular, is too much of an emphasis on the big business, big government model, to the detriment of the arts, the social sciences, and the humanities.
So as a professor, how do you deal with feeling that scale increasingly unbalanced, where your students are hopefully more aware, better prepared, more conscious of their place, their privilege, their ability to make changes, while at the same time the support for that kind of thinking or support period for those kinds of programs is increasingly evaporating?
Yeah, no, it's distressing. And, you know, in a peculiar way, it's also very short-sighted, I think, perspectives on the part of whoever it is that's running this show. I don't mean your show, I mean the university show.
The show.
The show.
The show, capital, yeah. Capital S.
I mean, in this capital sense, T. That, you know, we were talking just before we started here about the Great Depression and the New Deal. And, you know, the New Deal had many imperfections, but it did. One of the interesting things about it was that the government, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the New Deal program had an interest in the arts, in culture. So they had the Federal Arts Project that helped to subsidize painters, poets, writers. I mean, there's a little mural in the post office in downtown Santa Cruz. So when you're standing in line there, the next time you just look up, it's a picture of people working in the fields. And that was done during the New Deal by, you know, just some local artist. And with a little bit of government support to help them to feed themselves and their families. So there was a sense that even in the midst of economic crisis, art is important, culture is important. Number one, people produce it, therefore they should have, if that's their work, they should be able to do their work. But number two, we benefit from it by having our environment enhanced, our culture enhanced. So that's the one view over it. But today I see a tendency to think in terms of, well, the arts are just an appendage. We don't want to spend too much time on that. The literature, that's just something that a few people do, whereas it should be something for everyone.
Doesn't test well.
That's right.
You mentioned the depression and crisis, and a lot of your writing has been focused, or some of it has been focused on disasters, Hurricane Katrina, the LA riots, mm-hmm. Where, you know, a natural disaster, but also man-made disasters,
right.
And crisis that is instigated or manufactured or allowed to fester or encouraged or simply ignored, mm-hmm. until we reach a crisis point. And it seems like from a racial lens, annually there's a wake-up call, or in a generation there's a wake-up call, or we could list a million crisis points where it's like, Attica, what?
Right.
Everything should have changed.
Right.
The LA riots, that was an opportunity for dialogue. We were all supposed to figure it out after that because we knew it. Problems still hadn't gone away.
Yeah.
And then the earthquake and the Gina 6 and then we reached Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
And your writing and research came immediately following, one of the earliest publications following the storm, you know, the water draining,
right.
The book was going to
press.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Years have passed and we've obviously squandered that moment again before the next hurricane hits, or what next steps are you seeing? Because you started with an optimistic picture. You started with the students are starting to get it, and you know we have an increased consciousness. How do you reconcile those?
Yeah, no, I think it's difficult. Well, let's take the Hurricane Katrina book that I did. I mean, I was the editor of it. I brought it together. It has a lot of different people because I like to have different voices, not just my own. But one of the reasons it came out so fast is that it was done through a local independent nonprofit publisher, New Pacific Press, which is run by David Watson of the Literary Guillotine Bookstore. And David and I work together. We're friends. We know each other. So it's not a big publishing house. I never could have gotten it out through a big publishing house that fast in that way. And so that's a, you know, David is just quite willing, able. He's great to work on positive aspects. And so that's what made the book possible to a large degree. But I mention that largely because it's a good example of his nonprofit publishing house and the progressive philosophy behind it is a good example for me of what I would call prepositioned positive organizing. I don't know, maybe there's another term. I don't know. I didn't mean to make it sound so.
If we can make it into a good acronym.
Preposition, positive organizing. It's got three P's in it, so yeah. I guess it. One of the things I think we can do, and one of the things I think is going on, and that your show is another example of this. I mean, what we're doing right now is an example of something that's already there. It doesn't require huge amounts of money to do it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't require that you have thousands and thousands of people backing you to do it. It requires effort and discipline, and you know. And again, I appreciate the fact that you're doing it and that I'm able to be here to talk with you. But your work, New Pacific Press, are examples of, for me, of like thousands and thousands of groups like Butters Unidos in Santa Cruz that are already out here, doing work. And so it's not like we need to start from square one. I mean, there have been numerous wake-up calls, and maybe people are sleeping real soundly, right? but there are people who are awake, you know, who are doing things like your show, like the New Pacific Press, like Barrios Unidos, and there are thousands and thousands of examples of that. So for me, the issue is one not of creating something that doesn't exist, but one of coordination. How do we work together? How do we become more knowledgeable about each other? I mean, one of the things I notice when I do work in community organizations, like I was just speaking to a group of high school students in East Palo Alto in a mural project, a summer mural project that's really great. But they don't necessarily know about what's going on in this area or vice versa. Mm-hmm. I mean, we for all the talk about global intercommunication and instant knowledge and information, communities that are right next door to each other often don't know what each other are doing. And so for me, the issue is not how do we create grassroots organizations. I mean, I think they're out there. There's like thousands of them. It's how do we work together? Partly it's a matter of, I think, getting to know each other, but also a matter of, and this is what I talk about in my book on transcommunal cooperation, how do we do it with respect? Mm-hmm. That is to say, respecting the fact that there are going to be different viewpoints, philosophical, ideological, et cetera, and how do we do it in a way that allows us to cooperate and not be a melting pot, right?
So that brings up a lot of points, but this idea of progress and it's getting better, because I think you're absolutely right. That as you were speaking about East Palo Alto, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I probably know more about what's going on in Honduras with the coup because I've been researching it than I do about what's going on in East Palo Alto these days, and they're half an hour.
Right.
and just the access to information, because this thread that we've been going continually through is the notion of progress, or the globalization of knowledge and organizing, and so it seems like kind of the workshop model or the teach-in model of how we're going to work together and get along and come to a greater understanding between organizations or between groups of people is also evolving and changing, and it, from what it sounds like, students coming into the university, into your classroom, have an evolving understanding of things like their own privilege, mm-hmm. And the cultures of the world, their place in a global society. Mm-hmm. What are some next steps or other structures where you see like that models that have worked and you believe will continue to work, where, you know, other things we may be ready to move beyond.
Yeah. Well, I like to talk, as you can tell, and I'm a firm believer in the positive aspects of dialogue, but there are some settings that we probably can't talk our way out of because they're too difficult and too complex. So that's why I like to emphasize another thing, which I call it shared practical action, but it doesn't matter what the name is, but the idea is doing things together, actual projects. And it could be a big project, could be a small one. I know you've mentioned that you're going to be doing a walking tour of the history of race and racism in Santa Cruz. I mean, that's a project. I mean, that brings people together. They're doing something in common at a given moment. And that's really valuable in a variety of ways. It's valuable because of the knowledge it's going to impart, but also it's valuable because it's interactive. I mean, people are doing things together. And when you do things together, you find out about each other. What I would like to see more of with students at the university. Now, see, unfortunately, some of the budget cuts are going to make this even more difficult. It's the kind of thing that community studies tended to have ability to do, which is to have field study programs where students are out in the community. So they're not only reading is very important because you can read things from people who are long since gone and live far, far away. So I like reading. Reading is good. But it's also good to be out there face to face. And it's those face to face kinds of contacts that I think we need more of. And secondly, I would say my transcommunal ideal for a meeting of organizations is one in which no one gets up and says, okay, here's what we're going to do. It's more like, what are we all doing? Kind of go around the room, the talking stick that you pass around the circle. You say, okay, here's what we're doing. Here's the problems we have. Here's what's worked. Here's what's failed. Then you hear another group. And then you leave it up to, you know, some group. Group A says, okay, hey, you know, group C said something that we could help them with that. Or, you know, but it's kind of different from a meeting in which one group is trying to jam everything down someone else's throat. So it's more what is going on, given that, as I say, I think there's a lot going on. The more we have meetings about what we're doing rather than telling people what to do, I think it would be an important first step.
So that line or the continuum between a face-to-face dialogue and then shared practical action.
Mm-hmm.
Is what I'm getting at, and
okay.
and we start with the idea that you know we can talk our way through whatever it is that's keeping us apart. We can bridge gaps. And what happens when that doesn't go well? What happens when someone gets super defensive? What happens when you know, people feel attacked? What happens when I don't know, kind of touchy-feely workshop model of we'll talk our way through this and we'll come to a great understanding at the end of the day or at the end of the meeting, we'll shake hands and each have respect for each other. What happens when that goes wrong?
Yeah. Oh, no, that's a hard one, man. I mean, like, we're human beings. So, you know, we have dislikes. We have our own viewpoints. And not everyone is necessarily going to say it in ways that are respectful or polite. And so, all sorts of negative interactions happen in life. My model for what I call transcommunal cooperation, in which I think addresses the issue you just raised, is basically a Native American one from a particular group, the Iroquois or the Haudenosaunee people. And this was created, they created this about 600 years ago, but certainly before the Europeans arrived. I don't want to go into a long history. I know you don't have the time, but this is an alliance of five nations that they're still around in this area, but upstate New York and southern Canada. So, like, roughly from Albany, New York to Buffalo, New York, Toronto, south to the New York, Pennsylvania border. And originally, in their own history, says they were five warring nations that were at dreadful war with each other. So the Senecas in the east, where Buffalo is now, the Cayuga, the Onondaga in the middle, kind of where Syracuse is, the Oneida, who are my ancestral people on my mother's side of the family and the famous Mohawks in the east around near where Albany is now. And the history says that a peacemaker appeared, a man who worked with a woman named the Mother of the Nations. And he came with a message of peace. And I'll tell you a little bit of this because I learn from this every time I look at it. He appears at her door and she gives him food because those folks didn't start talking right away. They always kind of ate and sat back and chilled out a little bit. And then after he eats, she says to him, what message do you bring? And he says, the message I bring is that all people shall love each other, that we shall have one community. And she says, I love her because she's very practical. She says, thy message is good, but what form will thy words take when they come to work in the world? It's a great idea, but yeah. How is this going to happen, right? But he has an answer. I mean, and the answer is a very long one. It's the Constitution of the Confederacy. But the short answer is that he says we shall live in a longhouse. Now, these folks lived in longhouses that had many compartments for different families. So each family had its own space, its own hearth, its own fireplace, but they lived in one structure. A little bit like Martin Luther King's idea of what he called the world house. Mm-hmm. And so his image was that from east to west, from the Mohawks in the east to the Senecas in the west, there would be five different compartments of five different nations, but they would be part of one structure, the longhouse. And the great thing about that was that they could turn themselves on or off as the Confederacy. That is to say, when they needed to act as the Confederacy, they were the Haudenosaunee, the people of the longhouse, or the Iroquois, they became known as. When the Mohawks wanted to be Mohawks, or the Turtle Clan Mohawks wanted to be Turtle Clan Mohawks, they could do that. And
disassociated Confederacy in that could reconvene at any point.
That's right.
Interesting.
Right. So it was like you can deconstruct it or reconstruct it. Now, in most Western models of organization, which are kind of hierarchical, if you deconstruct it like that, the thing falls apart.
And it's a failure too.
Yeah, right. It's a failure. Right.
A failed infrastructure. An organization that ceases to exist is, you know, must have ended, you know, in flames.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So this was an organization that could cease to exist, come back into existence. And that meant that when they did have those moments that you were just referring to, like, say, moments when people really couldn't agree, they really couldn't get along, basically they could basically go into neutral, go into a neutral corner. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, say, okay, we can't agree on this. On this issue, you have to go be who you are, and we'll go to our thing. But there will be other issues. There will be other moments. And at those moments, we have a way of coming back together. Now, they had a whole elaborate protocol for how to do this. I'm not saying it's easy to do just by saying that. But the image is that a high degree of autonomy and respect for autonomy is good for overall organization in that kind of setting. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of my model for it. Yeah, we have to, sometimes if we're going to have real diversity, we're going to have real disagreements. See, that's one of the problems I have with something like when the university groups like it say, well, honor diversity. I say, yeah, okay, of course. But honoring diversity means also honoring the fact that people are going to really disagree, sometimes on very crucial issues to them that might really be close to their hearts. So then to go back to your question, mm-hmm. your point, how do you disagree about something you really feel strongly about, but come back and agree on something else you feel strongly about? And that's what the Haudenosaunee could do. And that's what, so it's within the range of human possibility anyway.
One can only hope. Organizational possibility. Another guest on this show or on the radio is Paul Kivel, who wrote Uprooting Racism. And he talked about how oftentimes the left or the group of people who identify as anti-racist and attempt to educate folks about diversity or cross-cultural cooperation have this tendency to think of it as almost evangelical work, where we're trying to convert people.
Right.
And there's that aha moment that we have to get everyone to.
Yeah.
And you just have to get people in the right environment and they'll join our team.
Yeah, yeah.
And how that's, you know, a facade. It's just propping up or it's at worst do-good activism where we're just making ourselves feel better. We tried, and it didn't work out, so I tried. But before we turned the mics on, we were kind of talking about, I guess, escalation in tactics, or getting to be able to work together on more valuable projects. Mm-hmm. When there's someone riding the brake, what are steps? What kind of processes have you seen that are successful models?
Yeah, well, you just used a key word, for, at least for me anyway, which was conversion. I mean, like being evangelical and trying to convert others. And look, I mean, I understand it. I mean, I have ideas. I think my ideas are really good, and I'd like other people to believe my ideas. But the subtitle of my book, Transcommunality, is From the Politics of Conversion to the Ethics of Respect. And the idea is that, again, how do we get along with each other even if we really don't agree on everything? So that's where it comes back to doing things. A few weeks ago, I had the honor of being at a Cinco de Mayo celebration at the prison at Tracy, California, mm-hmm. the Dual Vocational Institution, DVI as it is known. It used to be really vocational, but we have permission to go in there, and that's primarily through Barrios Through Needles, and it's like I've been teaching a course there for 2 years now, co-teaching on transcommunal cooperation. But the Cinco de Mayo, pronunciation. Part of it is a great cultural group who do Aztec dancing, right? And the last dance they do, and this is out in the prison yard, so it's Latino and prison incarcerated guys and anyone else who's there, African American, white, etc. And the last dance that's done there's a beautiful little child here who just took my hand, so you have to excuse me for a minute. did a friendship dance, and everyone who wants to comes down and forms a circle, and you join hands, and then they start moving around. It's kind of a snake dance, kind of move around real fast.
And this happened at DVI?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, it's amazing. I mean, great music group from inside. And, it's a wonderful moment. It's put on by the Mexican-American Cultural Committee at DVI. Okay. There's also a Juneteenth celebration later in the month that the African-American Cultural Committee puts on, and both of which I've been involved with through this class and through Barrios Through Needles. Anyway, so the guy who was on my right was a young white guy with a shaved head, tattoos. Now, out in the world, he would look like, quote-unquote, a skinhead. So here I am. I'm a person of color, Native American, African descent. And, we're standing next to each other because we're in a circle. We're holding hands. And one of the people, the organizers, is videotaping it for the Mexican-American Cultural Committee guys is videotaping the whole event. And as the camera comes around, the white brother turns to me and says, how's my hair look? I said, looks good, man. He says, thank you. Now, I don't know where that's going to lead, I mean, it wasn't like a big political moment, but it was a human moment,
And it's on his mind.
Yeah,
that's right. He's thinking.
Yeah, and it's on my mind, too, see? I mean, I have my own preconceptions and so forth and so on. And who knows where these things lead, but that's why doing things, and this would be impossible without the other interactions that are going on with the community and the people inside, et cetera. So that's why I can't overemphasize the importance of working together as a way of learning about one another, which itself has positive political potential.
So what kind of projects would you recommend for folks who are wanting to take that step?
Well,
what does Santa Cruz need?
God, that's a good question. I might be kind of speechless for that. I think we all have our own strengths. I mean, I like to write. I do a fairly good job of talking with different audiences in different settings. So if that's what I can offer, that's what I can offer. Now, there might be someone who can paint. you know, who might want to be involved with like a mural project, like the one in East Palo Alto, for example. Poetry, gardening, you know, food gardening. I mean, there are anything where one can bring skills and strengths to it, I think it opens the possibility for a huge variety of projects. I was just reading the obituary of a woman, Margolis in New York, who worked at Rikers jail. I mean, it's the city holding jail. And she helped to create a program of horticulture using the, I think it was the New York City Horticultural Society, as well as a culinary program with chefs from New York City coming into Rikers to teach cooking as a skill to a review called the Rikers Island Review. And I just found out about that today when I was looking at the obituary, so I'm going to work more on that, because that idea of a review, like a publication from inside, is interesting to me. And see, that's the kind of stuff I do, so I could offer that. But suppose someone is good at growing plants. I mean, maybe you could work out something with the system to help guys, you know, grow their own food. I don't know. I mean, but I say building on one's strengths, and we all have strengths. So
now you come from a wide range of teaching as an educator. It sounds like there's a first grade teacher in the family. You've taught in prisons and in universities. On one hand, there. It's the same. First grade, prison, teacher, educator. The model doesn't change that much. On another hand, obviously they're quite different.
Sure.
But I want to throw out a couple things that you've written about, and ask what we should be, or more importantly, perhaps how we should be teaching students about, for example, about Katrina. Yeah. What should students, whether first grade, high school, incarcerated, university students, what should we be teaching and how should we be teaching students about Hurricane Katrina?
Well, I'll just mention another piece I wrote because it has some relevance to your question. It's called Compass of Compassion, a Choctaw Vision of Hurricane Katrina. And it's about an essay or an editorial by a Native American writer, a Choctaw guy named Cedric Sunray, that I saw right after Katrina. It was in the newspaper called Indian Country. It's a Native American newspaper. And basically, he was expressing his compassion for, and connection to the people in New Orleans. And he says, every reservation has its lower Ninth Ward. And I was struck by that, and I wrote about it a little bit. In fact, I sent it to him, and we've been in contact since. I'm going to be going down to Alabama to see my family in next year, so I'm going to go to the Choctaw Nation on the Mississippi-Alabama border on their invitation to meet with them. But what struck me about him was that he recognized in an event that it did affect Native Americans, but was primarily affecting a low-income, poor population, primarily African-American, in an urban area. But he saw a tremendous connection between Indian Country, quote-unquote, and New Orleans. And there are many kinds of connections like that. I mean, one of the things I write about in that article is another situation, which was a mine disaster, in Sago, West Virginia, where several miners, who were white, were killed in a mine that did not have adequate safety equipment. You know, kind of the usual mine company story. And if you put those together, like vulnerable mine workers, vulnerable people on the reservations, vulnerable people in the inner cities, white, Native American, African American, they're all living in what I would call living below social sea level. And if there's, so rather than, I mean, every situation is unique. I mean, a mine in West Virginia is not New Orleans and vice versa, but vulnerability is something that a lot of us have in common. And ultimately, unless you're super, super rich.
And increasingly so.
Yeah, right. I mean, we all have different degrees of vulnerability. So it's in that sense that I think we have a huge amount in common that unfortunately usually gets kind of overwhelmed by other kinds of categories, like, well, he's black, she's white, he's Native American, he's this, she's that, whatever. When in fact, living below social sea level is something that's true for a huge chunk of the population. So once we grasp that, it seems to me, then that goes back to being able to work together and having to work together, you know, from a variety of different perspectives. I don't know if that responds to that or not, mm-hmm. but...
another topic is what should actually I want to back up and ask what your students at UC do know about your namesake, about John Brown.
Well, after they've taken a class with me, they know about him.
Well, I guess I'm asking because I hope they hear something. I hope you aren't the first person to tell them. I hope they shouldn't hear it from you. But I hope that they're coming to you with some knowledge in advance. Yeah. I hope it's being taught. I hope it's not your job for the rest of your life to teach everyone every day. My name is John Brown because.
Yeah.
And has that changed over the course of your teaching?
Well, I must say, I don't want to. I'm not sure what's going on in like the upper levels of the public education system in California. But when I ask my students, have you had courses in, say, African American history or the Native American history, something like that, I mean, before you got to the university, most of them say no. Now, I'm not expecting the public schools to do everything, but if you, I mean, somehow in the category, quote unquote, American history, a lot of things should be included, including South America, Central America, et cetera. But anyway, the students in many ways are, I think their consciousness of diversity is greater than what we used to see in the 1960s, what I had in the 1960s. The knowledge base is thin in many cases, unless people are reading independently, have read independently. And I think there's a tremendous need for a more fully dimensional, historical, cultural format of education in high school, I would say, especially in high school. And I don't mean Santa Cruz, the town, city, I mean just in California, probably in general. Because people don't know about John Brown. And in fact, some of the comments I get at the end of my courses usually is saying, you know, I appreciate having learned about. Now, of course, that's what I'm there for. I mean, you know, the idea is one teaches things that are not known. I mean, mm-hmm. that's fine. But I'm often surprised that I'm starting from square one when I think I should be starting from square 10, right?
Yeah. You know?
So I think more history. You know, and, you know, there are all sorts of good histories out there that are available now that weren't available 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. There's more information that's accessible. So we have greater access to knowledge, but a lower knowledge base. We have more of a consciousness and awareness or an understanding of our place or of terminology. But what have we done with it?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, it's almost like this, I hate to use a kind of a hackneyed expression, but an untapped resource. I mean, a tremendous amount of, I think, goodwill. Yep, right, just tap on it. Goodwill and a greater kind of just general awareness of diversity, human heterogeneity. Mm-hmm. I mean, just a tremendous complexity and pluralism of humans. But the knowledge base for comprehending it is thin. And so, I mean, I always say people should, you know, I always recommend people read on their own. I mean, mostly a lot of what I have a PhD, but I consider myself probably like a 60-70% self-taught person. I mean, over the years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had some great teachers over the years, and I appreciate them, and they helped me tremendously, especially when I was being told by my high school I was not college material and the usual kind of stuff that happens when you get into issues of class and race in the school system. This was a long time ago, in the 50s. But I also read a lot on my own and read a lot on my own, and novels, poetry, whatever, you know, just for fun. And I learned from all that. So the more people, and that's something everyone can do. I mean, just about everyone. Mm-hmm. And you don't need to have a teacher to do it. You can kind of get a book out and get an article and read it yourself.
So just this past week, there's a teacher in town, Jeff Duncan Andrade, was up at UCSC talking to the Masters in Teaching students. Mm. The co-hosts of the show here are both graduates of that program, and so the wheel keeps turning. We're churning out teachers, and one of the focuses of this talk that we went to was teacher training programs.
Okay.
And inspiring that passion for knowledge. That's exactly what you're describing. How do we support students in not just teaching what we want to teach them, but in teaching themselves, and that model of delivering more than information, but delivering a passion for knowledge and for the subject at hand. How's that work out in the university?
Yeah, well, it's hard. I mean, it's hard just because of the nature of the kind of, I have a class that goes for 2 hours. It meets twice a week. I see people in the class, and maybe I see some of them outside the class a little bit, but that's it. So it's not like, I mean, it is a kind of a peculiar teaching setting. I mean, for me anyway, and it's just the way I do things, but I try to speak personally in a sense like what we were just talking about, which is that reading really saved me. I mean, reading saved me. It helped me to get out of, I mean, I had a lot of support from my family, support from a few teachers, but I was confident about myself through the reading I was doing. I was reading history, I was reading anthropology, whatever I could get my hands on. And that was, but I tell stories like that, you know, so it's not just a dry kind of, you know, read, here's what you should read for next week, pages 1 through 40. I mean, I do that, mm-hmm. but but there's a reason for it. And I say, you know, I might say, well, when I first read these pages 1 through 40, it had this effect on me, and, you know, you'll be different, but, I think you can't teach a passion for knowledge, but you can kind of exemplify it. I mean, if you have it yourself. And mm-hmm. I think if you're a teacher, almost by definition, you will have it, because otherwise there are other jobs in the world to probably pay more.
Well, let's take a quick break and listen to a song, and we'll be right back. You're listening to John Brown Childs, retiring UCSC professor, author, and lifelong educator. Stay tuned. This is Teachers for Class War.
Well, that's great.
Above in heaven now are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down on the grave of old John Brown.
Glory, glory, hallelujah! Glory, glory, hallelujah! Glory, glory, hallelujah! His soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah! Glory, glory, hallelujah! Glory, glory, hallelujah! His soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah! Glory, glory, hallelujah! Glory, glory, hallelujah! His soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah! Glory, glory, hallelujah!
Men walking along the railroad tracks, going someplace and there's no going back. Highway patrol choppers coming up over the ridge. Hot soup on a campfire in the bridge. Shelter line stretching round the corner. Welcome to the new world order. Sleeping in the car in the southwest. No home, no job, no peace, no rest. Well, the highway is alive tonight, but nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes. I'm sitting down here in the campfire line, searching for the ghost of time. Prayer book out of his sleeping bag. Preacher lights up a butt and takes a drag. Waiting for when the last shall be first and the first shall be last. In a cardboard box near the underpass. Got a one-way ticket to the promised land. You got a hole in your belly and a gun in your hand. Sleeping on a pillow of solid rock. Breathing in the city aqueduct. But the highway is alive tonight. The way it's hit it, everybody knows. I'm sitting down here in the campfire line. Waiting on the ghost. Against the blood and hatred in the air. Look for me, Mama, I'll be there. Where there's somebody fighting for a place to stay. A decent job or a helping hand. Maybe somebody struggling to be free. Look in the eyes, Mama, you'll see me. Highway is alive tonight, but nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes. I'm sitting down here in the campfire line with the ghost of old time Joe.
All right, so back from the musical break, we had a call-in question that is a very good one. And that question is, as a teacher, what are 3 to 5 things that you wish... Three things that you wish that your students came to the university knowing.
Well, it could be three, or it could probably be a million, I guess. But one is just kind of the basic outlines of history. In particular, I would say history of the United States, but the history of the United States also includes the Americas. So I would say the importance of the Americas, South America, Central America, to North America. That's one thing. The other is the particular stories, the terrible histories of slavery, the removal of Native peoples from their lands, the way in which the United States expanded. And one can do this without being, you don't have to be super radical to do this, but just looking at how does the United States become the owner of what is now called the American Southwest, but which used to be Northwest Mexico, for example. Mm-hmm. That kind of history. The other aspect is one about cooperation among diverse peoples inside of that history. There are lots of overlaps. I mean, not everything works nicely all the time. Sometimes there's conflicts, but there are all sorts of contacts between Native Americans and African Americans, for example. Mm-hmm. There, in Florida in the early 1800s, hundreds of African people who escaped from slavery went to Florida, joined with the Seminole Native Americans, mm-hmm. and became known as the Black Seminoles, as a matter of fact, and fought against slavery for 40 or so years. And they later, along with the Seminoles, many of them they were forced out of Florida, not everyone, but many of them. They went to Kansas, Oklahoma, down to Texas, and then they went to Mexico, where they were welcomed by the Mexican government. So there you have a connection between Mexico, Native Americans, African Americans. And usually when people talk about, say, Native Americans, African Americans, Mexican, they think these are totally separate. And they obviously are distinctively different in some ways, but there's a lot of overlap. Slavery would have been impossible in this country, and indeed throughout the Americas, without the taking away of Native American land. The plantations are built on what used to be Native American land. So there's the history of Native Americans and African Americans is different in one way, but it overlaps in another way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And Mexico, when Texas was part of Mexico, Mexico abolished slavery right after independence. Mm-hmm. So a lot of Africans escaped who were in like Louisiana and Mississippi. They didn't go to Canada to escape from slavery. They went to Mexico. Mm-hmm. Mexico was a land of freedom. And there's some great books about this. I mean, this is not completely hidden history. There's a book called A Freedom on the Border by I'm blocking the name. But there's a great writer named Porter, his last name, people who write about this. Mm-hmm. So Mexico was a place of escape, refuge, and freedom for African Americans in the early 1800s. So today when I hear people talking about Mexicans, African Americans, they don't like each other. It would be wonderful if we knew about these moments when people had positive contacts and mm-hmm. were supporting each other. It doesn't mean the cultures are the same, but it does mean that they've overlapped and interacted positively over the years.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's definitely 3 to 5 things.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So another question that we wanted to ask was, just in the context of now, with the election of Obama as president, what are some ways as teachers that we should be teaching about the election and also the failure of our entire economic system? Those are both kind of separate questions.
Right, right. Well, they're probably connected in some way. I mean, it's complex stuff, and I don't claim to understand all of it. But I think... And Obama is a complex phenomenon, there's no doubt
Absolutely.
About it. But certainly, I think I was saying this when we were talking before the show started, that if you had asked me in 1965 when I was involved with the civil rights movement in mm-hmm. Alabama, I was working in a group called Friends of SNCC, the Student mm-hmm. Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I was not in SNCC, but I was in this support group for them. Mm-hmm. And I happened to be down there because they had asked for allies to come down. This is right after the Selma to Montgomery March. But if you had asked me then, is there going to be, which is going to happen first? Is going to be an African-American president of the United States or flying saucers are going to land? I probably would have said flying saucers are going to land first. Now, I'm being kind of flipped there, but not completely. I mean, what I mean is that even for those who were fighting for major change, it was hard to picture.
It was hard to imagine that, yeah.
Yeah, what the details of that would be and what how far that would go. So when you consider that segregation was a totalitarian system in which the police, the courts, the legislature, the governors, the entire apparatus of society was against any kind of change. A President Obama was hard to picture. So if there's one thing I learned from that is that is Fats Waller, the great African-American satirist and composer, said, one never knows, do one. You know, you just don't know what's going to happen. And that's why it's always important to try to do the right thing, regardless of whether you think it's going to have consequences or not, because it just might. In terms of the economic situation, again, I'm not an economist, but I do know that we are suffering today from, in part at least, from the Ronald Reagan formula, in which he said in his inauguration, government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the problem. Now, there are governments and there are governments, but there are ways to think about what I would call socially responsible government. And so not big government, not small government, but socially responsible government that kind of looks out for its citizens, and the citizens can look out for it. I mean, in other words, it's a mutual responsibility. And I think you saw a little bit of this during the Great Depression with the New Deal. The New Deal had all sorts of limitations. It was a product of its time, and you can't go back and recreate it, and probably shouldn't try to recreate it. But it did have that sense of what I would call a win-win mentality, which is people are out of work. You help people find work. You give them work that helps to train them. It could be bridge building, it could be art, it could be writing, it could be working in a printing press, whatever. And it's good for the individuals, but it's also good for society. And so rather than society and the individual being antagonistic, they were seen as somehow cooperative. I had the opportunity to live in the Netherlands when I had that Fulbright. My wife and I lived there. And I was really struck by how that society, which is a Western social democracy, is not a far-out radical society, but people there have a sense in which when they give their money in taxes, it's a social investment. They're investing in themselves and their neighbors, and
not a disconnect there.
Right. Mm-hmm. In this country, there's a disconnect for a variety of reasons. I mean, I don't like where some of my tax money goes.
Exactly.
I mean, I understand the sense of disconnect. But the Dutch were able to build the system that created the environment that allows to protect them from the ocean. It creates farms. It has a national health insurance so that no one is without health care by having that sense of connection between them and the government. So government for them is socially responsible. And that's, to me, if we could just move toward that, again, not big government, not small government, socially responsible government.
But and also participatory, you know, like there's responsibility, but there's also work that goes along with those taxes.
Absolutely. You know? Oh, yeah. There's a mutual responsibility. And it isn't that government's doing things for you. Government is an instrument of the people.
Yeah.
Or as Lincoln said, of the people, by the people, for the people.
Do you think that there's any, do you think that people just have such a, I guess not people, but you know, like the press is making such a huge deal out of like of socialism and how Obama's a socialist and how, you know, socialized healthcare. Do you think that there's such a stigma with that, that any move in the direction of what you saw?
Yeah, it is difficult, and I mean, I must say, in many most parts of the world, like Latin America and Europe, the idea that Obama is a socialist, people would just find that they find that really peculiar because, I mean, he's in most parts of the world, he would be like a centrist, probably, mm-hmm. If you do the left-right thing on the spectrum. In this country, though, I mean, my sense is we have a very short political spectrum. I mean, if you think of the left-right is like a ruler of 12 inches, 6 inches got cut off historically by the destruction of the left. Mm-hmm. So now we have a six-inch ruler in which the what used to be the center is now the left. Mm-hmm. But it's still the center.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, and so, but that's part of the reality. I mean, it is the reality of the country. There's no easy answer to that, and we still are suffering from all that Cold War anti-left kind of mentality that says anything in the form of socially responsible government is socialism and therefore is bad. But that's why I'm trying to think of words like socially responsible government. See, it's not socialist, it's
Sounds
not
better.
Left. It's, not, it's something that's responsible. And you know, we all like responsibility, I think. And social responsibility doesn't sound so bad. So socially responsible government should, I mean, you know, a slogan doesn't make things change. But I'm trying to work out of kind of the left-right dilemma because I think in this country, for a variety of historical reasons, it's very hard to be on the left and play in the mainstream and modify the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's rolled past 7 o'clock.
Okay.
So do you have any, do you feel like there's anything?
Well, no, I just want to say thank you. And again, to reiterate a point I made at the beginning or a comment I made at the beginning, this radio show is an outstanding example for me of the positive realities that are out here, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not a matter of having to kind of, how do we create something out of nothing? It's, how do we do, what do we do with all these somethings?
Mm-hmm. Santa Cruz has a lot of somethings. There really is. If you look around, like, there's a lot of people working on really positive, really radical projects
Absolutely.
In this town.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I really appreciate the invitation to
it's
be
a
here.
Pleasure. It's a pleasure to have you. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. Yep. That went by fast. Yeah.